I am so excited to welcome you to the first episode of the Line Poetry Podcast, which has been so many months in the making of editing, booking guests, and then re-editing, and just a bunch of late nights and work. Kind of a little bit of background about this podcast. So I'm a journalist. I'm a science journalist. I've written for The Atlantic, Washington Post, New York Times, places like that. But I'm really kind of a poet at heart. I studied poetry in college and have always wanted to go back and be able to do that kind of thing. And I was searching for podcasts that had a lot of good contemporary poetry read aloud, because I just wanted to hear the poems. One thing that I really miss from being in a poet community is hearing poems and being exposed to poems and just feeling alive that way. And I couldn't find anything. So, I mean, a lot of the poetry podcasts that I found were just very traditional poems and nothing from new and upcoming contemporary poets. So I decided to build that community myself with a Line Poetry Podcast. And I'm so excited that Kate Angus is our first guest. She's a really well-decorated poet, and her poem, Wild Rabbits Have Sharp Eyes, caught my eye in the Best New Poets Anthology of 2014. So when I first got that book in the mail, I opened it immediately, just like ripped open the packaging, was so excited to get it. And her poem was the first one that I flipped to, and I was just floored by how beautiful it was. And I read it a couple times, and then I immediately shot off an email to her and was like, can you please be a part of this new podcast I want to start? And she said that she would, and she was just a lovely, lovely person to talk to. So she received her BA from Brown University, which we talked about a little bit, and her MFA from the New School University. And she's gone on to do studies at Yale and Bernard and Columbia and Trinity. And she's also written for the American Literary Review, Southeast Review. She's also a really talented teacher and has been named by the New York Times as one of the teachers who's made a difference. So that's really exciting, and we talk a little bit about her teaching, and we talk a little bit about Augury Books, which is her publishing house, which she founded. So please do sit back and enjoy our interview with Kate. We start off with her reading a poem of hers, and then we delve deeply into her process and her background.
Okay. Wild rabbits have sharp eyes, which is another way of saying everything you want to hide blares like a motel's vacant sign. How long it took for you to tumble into sleeping on the couch, the bed stripped except for piles of laundry you could not bring yourself to put away. Do you remember when you didn't live inside the city's constant siren, when you were the teenager in the woods wearing dark like a blanket, the night studded with stars as many as your friends? It's just the past now. The teenagers you later taught are all adults now. They have children, lovers. You have a certain archive of a mind that files away the beautiful and practical. For example, the Amish cultivate saffron. For example, octopi have three hearts and die of starvation. The mothers stop eating to guard their unhatched eggs. So you know things. Knowledge doesn't fix the faucet whose drip stains the white sink chlorine blue. Information is only your own hands stroking your hips as you turn each night. What you would give to be a wheat field during a storm. Stalks bending, seeded by violent rain and the sky a clotted purple arch above you. Lightning strikes that jolt you so you remember, no matter how dead you feel, you are not dead.
So how did that poem start for you?
That poem particularly started for me. There's a line in it where I said, you have a certain archive of a mind. And I sort of listed out things, weird shit that I remember. And that is actually how it started. Like, for some reason, I cannot balance my checkbook to save my life. I forget people's names. I forget people's faces. I have no idea what capital of, like what the capitals are of what state, you know, or countries, any of that. But I do remember weird, arcane things, like that the Amish, you know, are really the biggest cultivators of saffron these days,
or, you know, that something called the Tasmanian globster washed, which is an unidentified sea monster, washed up on the shore, and, you know, people don't know what it is. So I know, like, weird cryptozoology facts. I know, like, old folkloric things. I just don't know practical things. And I think that knowledge is sort of what sparked that poem, just having a couple of strange facts and sort of thinking from that about my own brain and how it functions maybe in relation to other people's. And I think that is actually how a lot of my poems start. Like, I'll find a piece, and also my essays, actually. Like, I'll find a piece of information that really interests me, and then I just spin out from that.
I mean, it's mostly a thought, then, rather than an image or a line.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, maybe it's an image at times, like, linguistically, like, oh, like, that's a nice phrase, like, that would be a really pretty metaphor. Maybe that once in a while, but I think it's often more a weird piece of information.
So, speaking of esoteric knowledge, I think writers kind of thrive on esoteric knowledge. How do you have a method for keeping track of all the ideas that float through your head and float through your day? I know as a journalist, I kind of use Evernote, but you know, some of those things get captured and some of them are lost forever. So do you have a note-taking or idea-capturing device?
I do. I actually, as with just even things, errands that I need to run, I just email myself on my phone. Like, I can't even do that thing where people, like, talk to Siri, where they're like, Siri, remind me. Like, I don't do that. I just actually type out an email and it'll be like something about sleep paralysis, and I'll email it to myself, or it'll be as simple as, like, go pick up your laundry, Kate. But it's really, like, if I see something that I know that I want to remember, I just email it to myself, and then it sits in my inbox forever, or, you know, until I eventually use it.
So the title, Wild Rabbits Have Sharp Eyes, is such a vivid title, and I love it a lot. It's very memorable. Do you come up with your titles before you write a poem, after you write a poem, or how does that work?
I think it depends, actually. Sometimes it's before, and then the title will sort of been jammed down into the first line. Like, I do that a fair amount of times. Like, actually, in the Wild Rabbits Have Sharp Eyes, like, that title in jams down. And that title, actually, I stole from The Velveteen Rabbit. That's where it comes from. There's that scene where the rabbit, that he leaves, you know, the childhood story, like, the stuffed rabbit gets left outside, and because the boy forgets him, and these, like, real rabbits come up, and, like, they're like, are you a rabbit? And he's essentially like, yes! And then they're like, you don't look like a real rabbit. And the line is, like, wild rabbits have very sharp eyes. You know, so that actually is where that came from, and then I jammed down. And I do that a fair amount, but then I've also had some poems where I haven't, you know, I've just started writing the poem, I don't have a title at all, and then I get to the end of the poem and I think, man, I really need to explain what's going to be happening in this poem, so I'll stick in a lot of sort of exposition in the title. And so the title sort of serves the function of, here's the information that somebody needs so that they can just get into the poem.
So with all these wonderful disparate images and lines and ideas and thoughts, how do you make it all hang together? How do you make it all gel in a poem?
My God, does it? I don't know. I hope that it does. Whether or not I'm successful in doing that, I don't know that I could answer. I think a lot of what holds my poems together is a combination both probably of voice and also associative imagery. Like, I tend to leap from thought to thought, and I think that only works for certain types of readers. I'm sure that there are other readers that it wouldn't work for, where a lot more gel or, like, connective tissue would be something they would want. But I just get so bored by that myself that I sort of feel like I'm going to jump over here and hopefully, you know, people will jump over there with me.
Is there anything that you do specifically to massage or to make it hang on a little bit better?
Yes. Actually, yes, absolutely. Enjambment. I tend to do a lot of enjambment with line breaks because I think people are more likely, just naturally, we want to read to the end of a clause. And so I feel like if I can do enjambment to somehow lead people between things, they're more likely to keep going just out of, you know, sheer training in terms of grammar.
And how do you make that decision on what line or what phrase to enjamb on?
I don't think that I do make a decision. I think it's intuitive. I think when I go back and I look at my line breaks, And also when I'm teaching and I talk about line breaks with my students, I do tend to focus on ending with verbs or, like, interesting nouns. But I don't think that I have that really in place as part of my process writing it in any way other than just ingrained.
How long does a poem generally take? Do you have it sit for a couple months, or does it mostly come fully formed for you?
They come mostly fully formed, and sometimes I'll be able to finish the poem, like, from first draft to final draft within an afternoon. Or maybe I'll do a couple of drafts the first day and then do a final revising, like a final revision the next morning. But I also have poems that came almost completely to me, but like something was still not quite right, and I still had to do tweak. Like, I have one poem that was, it came fully formed, but there was something wrong with the hinge of it near the penultimate line, and I just couldn't figure out what it was, and I tried so many different versions because it was almost done. There was just one thing, like one word was off. It was driving me crazy, and I tried to revise it fairly consistently for about 4 months, and I couldn't get it to work, and I put it away for about a year and a half, and I came back to it, and I still could not get it to work. But I still knew it was like one word in the penultimate line was the problem. And then I put it away again for, I think, like another year. And then I came back to it and I just looked at it once and I was like, oh, of course. Bam. And I fixed it. And it was done. But I mean, the whole process itself took about 2.5 years, maybe 3 years to get it from start to finish.
Is there, I mean, in that case, you just had to let it sit and, you know, just marinate. But in other cases, if there's a word that's not coming to you or something that just doesn't sound quite right, is there anything, any methods that you use to combat that? Like, do you flip through thesauri or do you read other people's work or do you do any of that?
No, I really do just put things away and let them sit and hope that the word that I need or the image that I need will sort of bubble up from my unconscious at some point. Because I find the more that I try to actively search for things, the less I find them.
Did you grow up with poetry, or was that something that you discovered later on in life?
That's a great question, and I can start off by saying how grateful I am to my parents, because they did always read to us when we were growing up. Like, my mom had a childhood, I think it's like the childhood verse companion or something, and she would read out loud to us from that. I remember her helping me memorize William Blake's The Tiger. My dad used to recite Theodore Rothke's The Kitty Cat Bird to us. In fact, actually, last time when I was home for Christmas, he was reciting it again to me and my sister to prove he still had it memorized. So I was very lucky. I mean, it was just a normal part of our everyday lives in our childhood. I remember graduating from high school and friends of my parents asking, you know, what do you think you're going to do with your life, Kate? And what I specifically remember doing is responding, well, I mean, if I can't make a living as a film director, I guess I can always fall back on poetry to pay my bills. Just like, yup. And I so believed it because, like, my senior year, I'd won a fair amount of writing awards, so I'd actually, like, made, like, $4,000 from writing that year, which is a huge princely sum from poetry. As, like, an 18-year-old, so I was like, my God, I'm gonna get rich off this. It'll help fund my film directing habit.
So you're a teacher. Where are you teaching right now?
Well, I teach at a fashion college in Midtown, and I teach at Gotham Writers Workshop, and I also have a lot of private students. So I tend to teach them, like, at various coffee shops, or some of them at my apartment, or I actually have, like, one private student, this guy Herbert. He's 91 years old and a World War II veteran. He has a Purple Heart. And he has all these poems. He has over 2,000 poems that he's been working on. And he keeps hard copies of them in his freezer. But I know, right? It's like so amazing. But he also, you know, mails them to me on a zip drive. And I don't particularly like talking on the phone. And it's hard for him to leave his apartment. So we have an entire correspondence just with, like, written post. So I'll write out edits for him and I'll mail them to him and then he'll mail me back with, like, a letter, you know, saying, oh, like, this, I so appreciated this, but what about this other line? What should I do there? And, like, it's really lovely.
It sounds like fodder for a poem or an essay at some point.
Yeah, I probably an essay, because I'll want to be able to quote his poems in it.
And what are some common mistakes that you see your students make?
I'm trying to be diplomatic, and now now I've abandoned the idea. Not being interesting. You know, like, I know that sounds terrible to say, and I always pay attention to my students' work. Like, they've earned my interest by being my student. But I will frequently say, hopefully in kinder words when I'm in the classroom than this, if, you know, something like this came up in the slush pile, I wouldn't go past the first stanza. You know, people have really tired language, or they think because their heart is broken, they can say, my heart is broken. And that the poem will be successful that way. And I'm just like, no, it's not. I mean, it'll be successful for you in terms of emotional catharsis to write it. It might seem successful to people who already know and love you because they're already invested in your emotions. I was like, but to a stranger, if you have tired language, they won't care. You have to earn people caring about your work if they don't know you.
Yeah. And I mean, art is all about giving people a different perspective. Yes. So I guess if you don't have that different perspective, mm-hmm. then I guess that's
Or if you don't know how to voice it yet.
And so how do you help people develop that perspective or voice that perspective?
Usually through talking things through. Like, I'll say, this seems familiar. Are there different ways that you can phrase it? Like, what did it actually feel like? You know, what do you mean when you say that person is beautiful? Like, what, how, you know? What does that mean to you? Like, really, we'll often talk things through before they end up writing it.
It's kind of funny, because when I think about that kind of investigation, that deeper investigation into your emotions, into your life experiences, it's almost meditative in a way. I don't know mm-hmm. if you've come across Tara Brach or insight meditation or anything like that, but I'm a big fan of hers, and I listen to her meditations all the time. And a lot of her meditative practices are about, let's get out of the tire narratives that we have in our mm-hmm. world, and being like, oh, like, I was wronged, I was whatever, that kind of stuff. Yes. And instead think about the details of what happened without judgment, without that narrative. Mm-hmm. So I've always just thought that was interesting, that being Zen is actually conducive to good art.
I think it really is, especially if you're thinking just about like sitting with your body and sitting like with your breath. I mean, I think that's incredibly conducive to life in general, so of course art, but actually really just the specifics of being like, you live in a body, what does it feel like? You are breathing. Can you pay attention to that?
What's a good writing exercise for poets who might be listening?
Well, if they have a group of poets, if they have friends that they can do this with, or, you know, friendly strangers... One thing that I do with my class is sometimes I'll hand out index cards, and I'll have them very quickly write down a secret, and it can be a small secret or a big secret, I really don't care what, but not put their name on it. And then I'll collect the cards, and I'll shuffle the deck, and I'll pass them back out, and I'll ask people to write a poem about the secret that they get, as if it were theirs. And even if they get their own secret back because of, you know, luck of the draw, they have to pretend that it's not theirs. So that's one if you have a community. But actually... what I like to do sometimes when I can't think of something to write, I am obsessed with the website Atlas Obscura. So I'll just go there and I'll click around, because it just shows interesting places to go in the world and like weird, cool things you can find. So I'll just like go there and like at random click on a country and like a city and be like, oh my God, it's a beautiful like pool made of lava. Then like click around and see if there's something that I want to write about.
So tell me, so a while ago, you started your own press, called Augury Books, which I keep wanting to call Augury Press, but you've corrected me, so Augury Books it is. Can you tell me a little bit about how you started that, when you started it, and why you started it?
Mm-hmm. I started it 5 or 6 years ago with a friend from graduate school, in part because I just started sending my own manuscript around, and instead of feeling crappy about that process, I wanted to focus on making other books.
Like, it just seemed a lot more emotionally healthy to try to think about how can I bring books into the world instead of why is my book not in the world yet? You know, so it was focused in that way. And also, while, like, when we were founding it, that friend who's no longer on the editorial board, she left, and then a couple other people came on, so the editorial board itself has also shifted, and the press has changed in certain directions, too, because of that. Like, we started out off as a poetry press, now we also publish short story collections and memoir. But I think we also had been looking at a bunch of contests where it seemed like the people, and whether or not this is accurate, you know, how can you ever say if it's accurate? How can you possibly know the backstory? But it seemed like a lot of people who were getting published knew the judges or knew the presses. And these are, you know, paid contests that people are entering with a reading fee. And it just seemed really unsettling. So we also were very clear about starting the press where if you had a personal connection to us, you couldn't submit. You know, if you were a colleague, even there was one manuscript by somebody. It was, we loved the manuscript, but I happened to adjunct at the same school that he adjuncted at. And even though I'd never met the dude, I recognized his email from, like, faculty emails. So I was like, oh man, we can't publish him. Like, we have to, like, refund his entry fee and, like, tell him that we're, like, you know, that we can't even look at his manuscript. So we're very, very strict about that. And that's changed in some ways. I mean, now, if you've met me a few times, you can still totally submit to the press. But we still, if it's people that we're actually close to, even vaguely close to, we would solicit their work as opposed to, like, letting them enter our general submissions pile. I spent so long trying to publish my first book. I mean, I sent it around for like 5 or 6 years, and it was a finalist at a lot of like really fantastic presses, but, you know, it didn't actually hit. And I was like, what can I do? Like, I'm getting so sick of this. And I thought that the minute that I found a home for it, I would feel this incredible sense of relief, and like my life was changing, and I finally, like, you know, climbed that mountain. And instead, I was like, oh, yeah, now it's coming out. Crap, now I'm going to have to figure out how to get it reviewed, or like, damn, what happens once it's out? Like, what do I do with it? Am I going to have to give readings? Like, I worked so hard to get it to the stage, and now I'm like, oh, it's there, but it looks like there's more to do. Which is very strange, but I'm excited about it. And I'm also really glad that the press, it's coming out on Negative Capability Books. They're based down south, and they've been around for like 35 years, which is amazing to me as somebody running my own press. And I'm like, my God, to be doing this for like more than 3 decades is really admirable. And they were really open about letting me have some say in the cover design. And so the cover is going to be a painting of my cousin passed away last year, and he was a visual artist, and they're letting me use one of his paintings. So that is actually really important to me. I'm really looking forward to seeing Paul's painting on the cover.
And what is it about?
Oh, it's just, what is it about? God, no, who knows? It's my poems. I don't really know what they're about, really. I remember trying to write an artist statement for one of the residencies that I applied for, and I was like, what are you trying to conjure up with your poems? And I was like, I don't know. I think sometimes I just want them to be that feeling of listening to music when you're falling asleep at night. Like, you know, that when you're in that weird, like, half-dreamlike stage, and you kind of recognize the music, but you're also half in, like, your own sleep. Like, that's what I want my poems to do. So whatever that state is, that's what the book is about.
Kind of like the feeling of being alone but not being quite alone, which I think is the best feeling ever.
It really is.
Great. So what is it called, and where can people find it?
It is called So Late to the Party, and they will be able to get it through the press, Negative Capability Books. They'll be able to get it through small press distribution, so they can get it through SPD. They can probably get it through bookstores if they want to, like, go to bookstores. They can also go to my website, because I'm sure I'll have a link up to order it there. And my website is kateangus.org. So I'm apparently a nonprofit. And also because somebody else owns kateangus.com, even though they're not using it. And I'm too cheap to buy it from them.
So Kate took out her headphones before we got to record our goodbyes, and so the tape that we have is pretty echoey, so I'm not going to subject you to that horror, but we did say goodbye to each other. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. I know I learned a lot, and it was so lovely to talk to her. I did cut out a lot of great stories and great information. So if you would like to hear the full episode, definitely shoot me a message either on Twitter at American Haiku or by my email, jenny@jennyjchen.com. And let me know if you would like longer interviews. I decided to try to keep it short for the first couple of episodes. Also, if you want to hear more ear candy from Kate Angus, the next two episodes that you can download are her reading more of her poems. And they're just fabulous. So I really recommend that you download it. Please, please, please do leave a review and rate on iTunes if you can and if you enjoyed it. This really, really helps our ratings on iTunes, which helps other people who are looking for contemporary poetry and just looking for that kind of armchair poetry reading kind of experience to be able to find us. And I'd really like to build a community as quickly as possible so that we can all support each other in our poetry making, in our poetry reading. So definitely do go subscribe and rate on iTunes when you get the chance. Show notes and more information is available at linepodcast.tumblr.com. Stay tuned for the next interview, which will be with Mira Gonzalez. Talk to you soon.